Public Radio KMXT is supported by a grant from North Pacific Fuel, serving and continuing the tradition of excellent service to the community at three locations: Marine Dock at 715 Shelikoff Street, Gas and Go at the Y, and Gas and Go at Mill Bay.
It's nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT. On 100.1 FM, it is your public radio station here in Kodiak, Alaska, where it is foggy, misty, and wet. Out at the airport, they are registering northeast winds to 14 miles per hour, 96% humidity, and 1.5 miles of visibility. They're calling for showers for the rest of the day with a high near 57, east winds to 20. Showers are likely tonight, at least until 7 p.m. Mostly cloudy skies overnight tonight with a low of 51, southeast winds to 15. Coming up on the Midday Report, Kodiak's COVID-19 cases are trending downward, along with the rest of Alaska. And a family has been awarded Alaska Farm Family of the Year. We'll learn more.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. After months of extreme drought, the Dallas-Fort Worth area of Texas is now recording at least 7 inches of rain that fell in just 3 hours. There are records of far more that have fallen. A lot of rain in a very short amount of time, hitting very dry ground. And the result, life-threatening flash floods. NPR's Rebecca Hirsch reports this kind of heavy rain is more common because of climate change.
Relentless bands of rain are causing serious floods in Dallas-Fort Worth, as well as more rural surrounding areas. Flash floods have submerged cars and made sections of major highways impassable. And the rain keeps falling across the region, affecting millions of people in Texas, Louisiana, and Arkansas. Climate change is causing such extreme rain to get more common. A hotter atmosphere can hold more moisture. That means extra rain is falling in the heaviest rainstorms. And that extra water can be dangerous, especially in cities that have a lot of paved surfaces that can't absorb water, and storm water pipes that were not built for the current or future climate. Rebecca Hirscher, NPR News.
Ahead of its Independence Day, Ukraine is preparing for an escalation in Russian attacks. Air raid sirens sounded across the country today. Russia's intelligence service alleges a Ukrainian woman working on behalf of Kyiv was responsible for a deadly attack that struck Russian President Vladimir Putin's inner circle. Daria Dugina, daughter of the ultranationalist Putin ally Alexander Dugin, was killed in a car bomb attack over the weekend. The Ukrainian government denies involvement. White House Chief Medical Advisor Anthony Fauci says he's leaving public service. NPR's Franco Ordonez reports the nation's top infectious disease expert plans to step down from his roles at the White House and the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases by the end of this year.
Dr. Fauci says he'll be leaving in December to pursue the, quote, next chapter of his career. Fauci was 27 years old when he joined the National Institute of Health. He quickly rose up the ranks and eventually took over as the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, a position he held for almost 40 years. As the nation's top infectious disease expert, Fauci advised 7 presidents, beginning with Ronald Reagan. Former President George W. Bush awarded Fauci the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 2008. In a statement, Fauci said it was an honor of a lifetime to lead the NIAID for so many years through so many scientific and public health challenges. Franco Ordonez, NPR News.
Buses of mostly Central and South American migrants continue arriving from Texas to New York City, further vexing officials who accuse Republican Texas Governor Greg Abbott of using new arrivals as political pawns. They say roughly 2,800 asylum seekers arrived over the weekend. This is NPR.
NPR News is presentada a usted en parte por la Providence Kodiak Island Centro de Asesoramiento. Para una cita o más información, por favor llama al 907-481-2400.
For KMXT, I'm Terry Haynes. Cases of COVID-19 are on a downward trend in Kodiak. KMXT's Kirsten Dobroth reports it comes amid a statewide decrease in cases.
The Kodiak Island Borough reported 16 new cases of the virus this week, according to Alaska's Department of Health. Kodiak reported more than twice that number of cases just 2 weeks ago, although those numbers don't necessarily factor in positive at-home tests. Alaska still has one of the highest case rates in the country, although cases of COVID are down statewide. Alaska's Department of Health reported just over 2,000 cases of the virus this week, with 86 people hospitalized across the state. There are currently no hospitalizations in Kodiak. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention loosened some of its COVID-19 guidelines just last week, citing both falling case numbers and increasing immunity in the U.S. due to vaccinations, infections, or both. However, anyone showing symptoms or who knows they've been exposed to the virus should still wear a mask and get tested. More information about the new guidelines and local case rates is available at the CDC's website. That's cdc.gov. In Kodiak, I'm Kirsten Dobrath.
A family with deep roots in Soldotna has been named the 2022 Alaska Farm Family of the Year. The award comes nearly 75 years after the family first homesteaded on the Kenai Peninsula and set up a commercial farm there. KDLL's Sabine Pooks spoke with the current owners about that history and has this story.
Martha Mary's home on Pickle Hill is a bona fide farmhouse. The dozens of garlic plants drying on the floor of her living room during a rainy spell are a dead giveaway.
The instructions I read on curing garlic was withdraw water from it for a week or so before you pull it.
It's a little late in the season for garlic. Mary, stepping over a row of scapes, says she's not sure she's going to bring this garlic to the Lancashire farm stand at the market like she usually does.
So I'm just going to mince those and use them for the family.
Which we do love it when the garlic scapes come on.
Martha Mary and Amy Seitz run Lancashire Farms in Soldotna. And this year, they're the Alaska Farm Family of the Year, an accolade given by the state at the Alaska State Fair to honor a family that epitomizes a commitment to local agriculture. Lancashire Farms has been committed to that goal for longer than most. Larry and Rusty Lancashire arrived in Alaska in 1948 by way of Ohio. They were some of the first homesteaders in Soldotna and one of the few homesteading families that farmed commercially and stuck with it. Mary, not even 5 years old in 1948, says her dad's interest in farming was rooted in his time in World War II. While he was serving as a pilot, his plane was shot down, and he spent over a year in a prisoner of war camp.
While he was there, Red Cross would send some books. Some were about farming, and so he looked at some of those. And
after he got out, he tried careers in insurance sales and in crop dusting, but Mary says neither stuck.
So then when crop dusting didn't pan out and insurance didn't pan out, and he decided to come north. So it took him quite a while to drive a half-ton Jeep pulling 4 tons on a trailer up the Alcan.
When the Lancashires finally arrived in Alaska, they set up shop on the property the farm sits on today, on Pickle Hill.
I think Dad always had in mind having a commercial farm. So first everybody needs to have eggs, so he raised chickens.
But the neighbors weren't so warm to the idea at first. Mary says the people in nearby Kenai were so used to eating dried eggs that they didn't take much to their fresh ones.
And so Dad tried dairy cattle. After all, every family needs milk. But likewise, the people in Kenai were so used to canned milk that they didn't like fresh 33% Guernsey gold.
Finally, the family got into potatoes. They'd sell them on contract up at Anchorage. And eventually, Larry Lancashire got out of the farm business altogether. He bought Larry's club in Soldotna and became a commercial fisherman. But farming stayed in the family. His granddaughter, Amy Seitz, grew up spending summers on the farm and doing 4-H.
Which I've always been interested in the farm. I always knew this is where I wanted to be.
Today, the farm does most of its sales directly from the property and at the Soldotna Saturday Farmers Market. They also sell eggs to Odie's, plus yarn spun from their sheep's wool at shops around the peninsula. And they're working on expanding how much they can produce, bringing in more sheep for the meat and fiber, and expanding production on plants, like the garlic.
We need more layers. We need to do more meat chickens. We need to sort out our sheep and have more production there.
And the historic farm has been adding new plants into its rotation too, like yadfa, a brassica from Asia, and celtis, a cultivar known for its thick leaves and stems. Seitz is also the head of the Alaska Farm Bureau, and she says there's a lot of enthusiasm today statewide about local food, driven in part by the recognition that Alaska's really cut off from the rest of the world. Mary also says people recognize that local produce just tastes better. It's a far cry from those early days in Kenai.
I think there's a lot of interest in homesteading and growing gardens and learning how, and I think that is really good. So I think it's important that we as farmers reach out and help individuals learn to garden on their own area.
Mary and Seitz are heading to the State Fair in Palmer this weekend. They'll be presented with the Farm Family of the Year Award on August 25th.
In Soldotna, I'm Sabine Pooks.
Earlier this month, Dillingham held its annual Mud Run. It's an outdoor event for kids to get active. It's back after being gone for 2 years. KLDG's Catherine Moncure has the story.
On a sunny afternoon in Dillingham, a series of large wooden trays filled with mud line the gravel path by the softball field. It's the Mud Run, an obstacle course organized by the Bristol Bay Area Health Corporation. The Mud Run is back after a 2-year COVID-19 hiatus. It's an opportunity for kids and some adults to get outside, get active, and get, well, muddy. A giant inflatable arch marks the start of the course. In true Bristol Bay fashion, the theme of the Mud Run is salmon. Volunteer and participant Deanna Beyer describes the setup.
So we've got different stations where the participants essentially are salmon and they're going through or under a gill net. They're going past bears. They're going up a fish ladder or waterfalls.
Kids hop over logs and wriggle through the mud, trying not to get caught in the net. The bears are high schoolers on the cross-country team, pelting the younger children with water balloons. Then they get doused in bright color powder as they run back toward the starting line. The mud that everyone is crawling, jumping, and splashing through came from Kanaknak Beach. The Dillingham cross-country coach volunteered her team to set up the course, so the group of runners hauled the cold mud from one side of town to the other.
So we brought a few totes, some people, and some shovels, and we kind of like put them in a certain way so we can just drag all the dirt into the totes.
That's Mud Run participant Dylan McCambly. He explains the scientific process of how they created the perfect batch of mud.
And then we brought him here, put him in the tarps, and just put some water on him, and eventually with some mixing it turned into some mud.
Not everyone is as comfortable with the mud as Dylan is. Cross-country coach Amanda Leighton has brought her 5-year-old daughter, Leah, to the Mud Run, too. When asked if she enjoyed the race, she has mixed feelings.
Yeah, but I didn't like that it squished in my shoes.
Leah's mom asks her to elaborate.
Did the mud feel good?
Yeah, but I know.
No. No, is it because your shoes kept falling off?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Do you want to do it again next year?
But it's so muddy, too muddy.
What if we had boots on?
Perfect.
In Dillingham, I'm Catherine Moncure.
Oil and gas company Marathon Petroleum says global instability is complicating its plans on the Kenai Peninsula. It's still aiming to turn a decades-old liquefied natural gas export plant there into an import facility so it can bring in fuel for its crude oil refinery down the road. But it wants more time. Federal regulators granted a project extension on August 16th, pushing the project deadline back to 2025. The company says the future of the project will hinge on whether it can find a competitive fuel source, which in today's market is looking more challenging than ever. KDLL's Sabine Pooks reports.
Jason Fear is the global head of business at a Houston-based intelligence firm. He says Marathon isn't the only business looking for cost-competitive natural gas right now. The war in Ukraine has created an unexpectedly high demand for it overseas.
That has pushed prices up very high.
And that complicates Marathon's plans to start importing gas to the facility near Nikiski. The facility was previously an exporter of liquefied natural gas. And for 5 decades, it was the only one in North America. But as the global natural gas market became more competitive, then-owner ConocoPhillips mothballed the facility, and Marathon took over ownership in 2018. A year later, Marathon subsidiary Trans-Forland Pipeline applied to turn the export facility into an import one. Federal regulators told the company it had until December 2022 to do so. But in a filing last month, it told regulators it doesn't expect to finish the project by then, quote, despite good faith efforts to do so. And it said the global instability from the COVID-19 pandemic and the war in Ukraine have given the company pause in making a decision about the project and its fuel supply source. Fear says that instability is driven by increases in Europe's demand for LNG as Russian suppliers cut back.
So you would think the next few years are going to see some pretty high LNG prices that would, you know, make sort of new entrants into the LNG market really think twice about whether it's competitive. And they would really have to sort of dig into the details of how they're going to use it, how much it's going to cost.
The natural gas would likely be a source of fuel for Marathon's own crude oil refinery down the street. But now it's a question of where the company will get the gas from and whether it can get it at an affordable price. And Fear says it might take 3 or 4 years at least for producers in the U.S. to build up the capacity to meet the high global demand. Still, the company says it's confident the project is still commercially viable, and Fear says it wouldn't be too big of a lift for Marathon to convert the facility from an export to an import one, since it already has a lot of the tanks and jetties that it would need in place.
So this isn't a huge stretch.
That said, he says those costs aren't inconsequential. And he says companies will first want to make sure they can recover their investments before they pump any money into a new project. In Kenai, I'm Sabine Pooks.
Ketchikan welcomed a new U.S. Coast Guard cutter on Friday. KRBD's Eric Stone went down to Ketchikan's cruise ship docks to watch the 154-foot Douglas Denman sail in.
The new fast response cutter Douglas Denman steamed down Ketchikan's Tongass Narrows on a blue sky day, led by a 45-foot response boat from the local Coast Guard station. Executive Petty Officer Coleman Aldrich brought the whole family out to the downtown cruise ship docks to watch the new boat come in. He says it's not just a homecoming for the cutter. Crew members from Ketchikan have been working on the boat, running drills and training since March.
It's really cool for me to stand here on the pier and welcome another crew in, knowing that all the trials and tribulations they've been through and, you know, all the hectic days, long hours that they've put in. So it's really very rewarding to see all that come to a close and just be like, hey, we made it home. Everybody's safe. The cutter's safe. And we can see our families again.
He says the crew picked up the cutter in Louisiana, took it to Key West for outfitting, and then sailed through the Panama Canal and up the West Coast to its new home port.
It's a pretty significant event. So, and I know the guys are really, really excited to be home.
Allie Olson says she was glad to see her husband, a bosun's mate first class, assigned to the Douglas Denman after a long time away.
It's very exciting. It's really cool to see how the crew has gotten to know each other and how they've built their workforce. And the families here in Ketchikan are also very supportive and tight-knit, and we're all very excited to have them home.
The Douglas Denman will stay in Ketchikan temporarily while port facilities in Sitka are under construction. It'll be the third fast response cutter in Ketchikan for the time being, joining the Bailey Barco and the John McCormick. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Eric Stone.
KMXT Local News is underwritten in part by
GCI. GCI has adjusted store hours across the state to keep our customers and employees as safe as possible during this time. The most up-to-date store hours are available on GCI.com.
Read diverse, read indie. On Insight Daily Radio, conversations with today's most influential authors from the world of independent publishing. The controversial, suspense-filled When Her Hand Moves by author Omar Imadi consists of three thrilling novellas, including the mysterious disappearance of a Syrian woman, a Syrian professor on the run as he finds himself caught in an erotic trifecta, and the frantic quest of an Oxford scholar to decipher an ancient manuscript. Combining the sensual and the sacred, the intellectual and the imaginary, the divine and the dangerous, we spoke with him about this fascinating book.
The fact that I was born in Damascus to an American mother and a Syrian father, I think, begins the story in a sense, because when you don't quite belong to any specific place, you tend to observe more. Because you have this vantage point of distance. You're not actually Assyrian in the full sense of the word. You're not from Damascus, as my friends were. Not in the same way. And of course, you're not quite American. So this distance creates an observation or perspective. And I think you start sharing these stories in your head of what you're observing. And so in a sense, as always, writing a story. There's always a story. And sometimes you have to translate the story in two ways, not quite translate from one language to another, although that would take place. You start seeing yourself as a bridge.
That's author Omar Imadi on When Her Hand Moves, which has just been released. Read Diverse, Read Indie is presented by the Independent Book Publishers Association.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon and welcome to a misty Monday. It is the 22nd day of August, the year 2022. The sun rose at 6:49 this morning. It won't set again until 9:34 tonight. That will give us 14 hours and 45 minutes of daylight, a loss of 4 minutes and 47 seconds compared to yesterday. Our record low for this date was 38 degrees. That was set in 1986. And our record high was 81, set in 1948. We have a high tide coming up pretty soon here on the east side. That will happen at 12:58 p.m., about 1 p.m. Be a 5.7-foot tide, followed by a low tide at 5:23 p.m. That will be a 4-foot tide. Our high tide for tonight will be 11:33 p.m. and 7.8 feet, and our low tide for tomorrow morning here on the east side will be at 6:56, 7 a.m., and be 0.8 feet. Over on the west side, you have a high tide coming up at 1:09 this afternoon. That will be a 9.2-foot tide in Larsen Bay, followed by a low tide at 6:19 this evening of 5.8 feet. Your high tide at midnight will be at 12:04 a.m. and be 11.6 feet. And your morning low tide on the west side will happen at 7:17 a.m. and be 0.9 feet. Well, let's check in with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
Hello, this is the Alaska Department of Fish and Game in Kodiak with Kodiak Commercial Salmon Fishery Advisory Announcement number 29, date issued 10 a.m. on August 22nd. There will be a 48-hour extension to the current commercial salmon fishing period from 6 p.m. Monday, August 22nd, until 6 p.m. Wednesday, August 24th, in the following areas: in the central and north Cape sections of the northwest Kodiak District and the Iziut and southwest Afognak sections of the Afognak District. Closed waters are expanded until 6 p.m. Wednesday, August 24th, in Molina Creek to consist of all the waters within 1/2 nautical mile of the beach near the stream terminus of Molina Creek, stream number 251-105, between 58 degrees 10 north latitude and 58 degrees 11 north latitude. The following areas will close at 6 p.m. Monday, August 22nd: the Duck Bay, Outer Katoy Bay, Raspberry Strait, southeast Afognak, and northeast Afognak sections of the Afognak District, the east side Kodiak District, except for the inner Ugak and outer Ugak Bay sections remain closed, the Cape Alitak, Humpy Deadman, Alitak Bay, Mosier Bay, and Olga Bay sections of the Alitak District, the outer Iakulik section of the southwest Kodiak District, and the Cape Igvac, Wide Bay, Alinchak Bay, Katmai, and Dakovac Bay sections of the mainland district. Fishermen are reminded that until further notice in that portion of the northwest and southwest Kodiak districts south of the latitude of Cape Kuliak, king salmon 28 inches or greater in length may not be retained by purse anglers in the commercial fishery and must be returned to the water unharmed. Other closed waters are shown in the Kodiak area salmon statistical chart and detailed in commercial salmon fishing regulations. And statistical charts, harvest strategies, and commercial salmon fishing regulations are available at the Kodiak Fish and Game office. And, of course, the most recent salmon fishery information may be obtained by calling the department's 24-hour recorder phone at 486-4559. Thank you very much. Good luck fishing. And this is the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
Mariners, here's your forecast for Marmot Island to Sitkanat, Kodiak's east side offshore. Small craft advisory through Tuesday, east wind 30 knots today, seas to 10 feet. For tonight, southeast 25, seas to 8 feet. And the same forecast for tomorrow, southeast 25, seas to 8 feet. Over in the Shelikof Strait, small craft advisory for today, northeast 30 today in the Shelikof, seas to 10 feet. For tonight, east 15, seas coming down to 6 feet. And for tomorrow in the Shelikof, east 20, seas to 7 feet. Correction, seas to 5 feet. The Board of Education will be having their regular meeting tonight at 6:30 p.m. in the District Services Conference Room. That's room F-140 of the old high school wing. The meeting will be streamed through BlueJeans, and meeting information to log in is posted on the Kodiak Island Borough School District's website under the Board of Education tab. For more information, contact the Secretary to the Board of Education at 907-486-7566. The Kodiak City Council will be having a work session tomorrow and a regular meeting on Thursday. Both of these meetings begin at 7:30 p.m. and will be held in the Kodiak Public Library. The meeting is open to the public. Public members are encouraged to tune in to KMXT on 100.1 FM as well, and the meetings will be web streamed. The web streaming link and meeting packets are available online at the City of Kodiak website. If you need more information, contact the city clerk at 907-486-8636. All are invited to the Lutik Museum's annual meeting and open house. It is 1 to 3 p.m. next Saturday at the Lutik Museum. The board meeting starts at 1 p.m. and it will be followed by the open house at 1:30 to 3 p.m. The executive director, April Lactonen Counselor, will provide presentations on recent projects and the museum renovation plans during the board meeting portion. After the meeting, stay for the open house, and you'll be able to see artifacts up close, explore some educational materials, enjoy museum exhibits, and meet the full staff to ask questions about their work. It's also a great opportunity to view the headdress and masks, which are on loan from France before they are returned this fall. Let them share all the exciting things happening at the Lutik Museum. It's free and open to all, and again, it's 1 to 3 p.m. next Saturday at the Lutik Museum. The Hospice and Palliative Care of Kodiak is hosting an 8-week grief recovery method program. It runs every Wednesday from 5:30 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. starting September 7th. It's going to be held in the multipurpose room of the Kodiak Public Library. It's an opportunity to learn effective tools for how to process feelings of pain and loss while also learning how to live with grief in a manageable way. It will be done in an interactive and supportive environment and facilitated by a qualified grief specialist. Space is limited, so please register by calling 907-512-0600 or visit their website at www.hpck.org. The Kodiak Community Foundation and the Kodiak Arts Council are hosting a downtown block party on Saturday, September 10th. It's going to be from 2 to 8 p.m. It's a free community-wide celebration featuring local live bands and musicians, a nonprofit fair, cultural arts performers, food trucks, and more right in the heart of Kodiak. The goal is to host an annual event celebrating our vibrant community while offering local nonprofits an avenue of exposure. The street fair and family fun start at 2 p.m. and go to 4 p.m., and local bands, performers, and musicians begin at 4 p.m. all the way through 8 p.m.
The polls have closed on the August 16th primary election. Preliminary results have been released online by the Alaska Division of Elections. Final results will not be posted until Wednesday, August 31st, giving time for all ballots postmarked by Election Day to be counted, including mail ballots from rural Alaska, from college students in the lower 48, and from Alaskans serving in our military abroad. This message sponsored by Alaskans for Better Elections.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT two times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m. and during the midday report at 12:20. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181. Fax us at 486-2733 or email psa@kmxt.org.